Good evening. Welcome. Welcome to all of you, to our students, our campus community, and welcome back to friends and alumni and graduates of the college. It's our day of gratitude and reunion weekend, and we're glad to have you folks back with us this weekend. I'm Walter Sterling, the Dean of St. John's College here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to tonight's installment of the Dean's Lecture and Concert Series. We have a tradition at the college. Some people don't want me to even say this anymore, but I'm going to say it. We have a tradition at the college of not introducing our own, and I'm not going to introduce my colleagues with all of the bells and whistles and credentials and accomplishments that they deserve, but I want to welcome them and thank them for participating in this tutor panel this evening. We have a panel with Judith Adam, Seth Applebaum, Grant Franks, Eric Popoli, and Ahmed Siddiqui on Freshman Laboratory and the laboratory's place in the liberal arts, and we're happy to have you all here with us. The panel itself will go for about an hour, and then we'll take a 5-10 minute break with refreshments, and then we'll come back into this space for a question period and conversation afterwards. I do want to forecast the next couple of weeks. We have two lectures by our colleagues, Martha Franks, who's here tonight, is lecturing on constitutional law in the Supreme Court next week, and then the following Friday we have Richard McCombs lecturing on Pascal. So please join us for both of those talks. I'm now going to read what my colleagues wrote about the panel this evening. I'm going to add a thought or two. Because it attempts to engage directly with the natural world and the question of nature, Freshman Laboratory is possibly the most radical of beginnings that we make in our studies at St. John's. Tutors will discuss some of the first themes of Freshman Laboratory and its challenging readings, looking, classification, causes, how these themes help us to approach and come to know the natural world, and how such beginnings might relate to our extended study of science throughout the laboratory program at St. John's. And I just want to add, in the spirit of those remarks, that I think many of us believe that as distinctive, radical, extraordinary as it is what we do with all the books here, reading Homer and Plato and Aristotle and Descartes, Kant, Hegel, doing all of those things and doing them the way we do it, even rarer, even more unusual, even more radical is what we do with mathematics, natural science, and the laboratory more broadly. It's a remarkable undertaking, and some of us think that it's hard to understand how a liberal education today could be accomplished without going to the roots of natural science and without doing what we do in that part of our program. And it's certainly with that spirit and that conviction that I have that I look forward to learning from what my colleagues have to say today. And with that, we will begin with Ms. Adam. Please join me in welcoming Judith Adam.
Thanks. I'm relieved because I don't have any bells and whistles, so I was glad just to come up here. One of the challenges of Freshman Lab is in working out for ourselves in what way it constitutes a whole or even a unified project of study. It's a class with a name, laboratory, that seems familiar enough today, but it comprises a range of texts, subject matters, and themes and lacks the immediate available coherence of the other freshman classes. It doesn't seem to fall obviously under the traditional liberal arts as articulated in the college's catalog, and it has two very distinctive aspects that can seem difficult to blend and even might compete with each other for our attention. That is, the reading of texts on the one hand and the practical things or the practica on the other. So even the student who finds this class endlessly full of wonders might reasonably ask himself, like Goethe's young addressee, lost in the garden of the metamorphosis of plants, what this is all about. Now, there is a way to sum up Freshman Lab, at least provisionally. It's the study of nature and its questions. But here again, we cannot take for granted that we know how and what this study is, even as we attempt to engage in it, any more than we can assume we know what geometry really is before spending some time with Euclid. And furthermore, in pursuing the question of what nature itself is, we're powerfully challenged by the realization that the most committed teachers and thinkers of nature, the ones who take nature itself as a question, are ancient thinkers, one thinker in particular, whose views seem suspiciously at odds with the modern scientific ones to which we might already be quite attached, body and soul. But the lab wonderfully gets past this uncertain starting place beautifully, and it does it beautifully, in my opinion, with a deceptively simple and practical gesture. In our first classes, by our own lights, we go outside and look at things, at living things, or sometimes just a single living thing. We're instructed to look and to draw with paper and pencil, to attempt to truly see what we see. Telephone photographs are forbidden for reasons that don't always seem immediately obvious. This activity is gently supported by one or more short readings, including the brief and charming confessional of the travails of a young biologist in training, Scudder, in his enforced and unending examination of a stinking specimen of fish over several weeks. This latter reading is meant, I think, to help us address early on the dual problems of disgust and boredom in the lab, of stomach-turning disgust at the unpleasant things we might encounter, particularly on the dissection bench, and the disappointing boredom that erupts when faced with pondering the same initially obvious thing for more than 10 minutes at a time. And it isn't surprising that in these first looking exercises, at least one or two of us are asking if we can draw something else already, or head back to the cafeteria for lunch, since we believe ourselves to be well and truly done with the assignment. Perhaps we take our faculty of sight for granted, but it turns out that looking is not that simple. It requires effort and practice. But what is the purpose of this emphasis on looking? We make time for a fair bit of it throughout freshman lab, but our aim is not, it seems, to train botanists and biologists for future fieldwork or expert dissectors for medical research, although this is not to be ruled out for some. It's possible that what happens in these simple exercises, or practica as we call them, is the quiet cultivation or drawing forth of something of a philosophic attitude in us. The time and space dedicated to this pondering at the beginning of freshman lab prepares the way for something like genuine leisure in our learning, as perhaps no other class at the college can do. And I'm certain that it helps to rekindle or bring out some of the childlike wonder we have for the world, which in turn might draw us on to a simple and immediate contemplation of things. Some few texts we read invite reflection on the meaning of seeing itself, a theme in the lab. I'd like to take an inadequate glance at two of these in the time remaining. First, there's an old tradition of having Leonardo da Vinci's notebooks on anatomy on hand to accompany our animal dissections. They present beautiful and deep drawings of human beings from womb to adulthood, and searching notes that reach beyond mere anatomy. To assign this book is dangerously like offering up the equivalent of the Platonic form of dissection notes as a model for beginners. But there's more than a model of fine art here in Leonardo. His thinking about his work also presents us with a radical claim about the power of seeing and drawing. As Carl Jaspers describes it, for Leonardo, seeing and drawing amounted to a kind of knowing. Seeing was a kind of knowing. And to quote, Leonardo's thinking, and this is its distinctive feature, is based entirely on the eye and the hand. What has existence for him must be visible. What he knows must be brought forth by the hand. And then later on, but what the eye perceives becomes clear only when the hand creatively reproduces it. In dissecting an organism, the hand thinks in movements without words. And it does the same in drawing from nature or in projecting a design of the imagination, which creates what nature had not produced before. This thinking, not in concepts, but in lines, forms, and figures, is vision and action combined. There is something here that rings true at the bench in our dissections. It is indeed a shocking experience to discover the parts of the flower only as we attempt to draw the flower. And we do seem to, come to know so much through seeing and drawing. But I've wondered about how far Leonardo intends us to take this identification of seeing and knowing. How, for example, should we understand the questions we raise when we study the natural things, even as we're drawing them? Is that seeing as knowing? And aren't we sometimes already in advance looking for something in our explorations of the natural world, rather than allowing the visible itself to explain itself? What do we, or what should we bring with us to our seeing and to our looking? A second text on the theme of sight or seeing that we take up is an excerpt of the introduction of Aristotle's Metaphysics, a book that doesn't obviously belong in the lab, although Aristotle's biological works do form the textual backbone of the class. But the first chapter of the Metaphysics presents a sort of summary of our intellectual life and gives particular attention to our senses and especially to sight. Aristotle begins the Metaphysics, he begins the whole Metaphysics this way. All men by nature desire to know. An indication of this is the delight we take in our senses. For even apart from their usefulness, they are loved for themselves. And above all others, the sense of sight. For not only with a view to action, but even when we're not going to do anything, we prefer seeing, one might say, to everything else. The reason is that this, most of all the senses, makes us know and brings to light many differences between things. I find this beginning of the Metaphysics moving and beautiful. It speaks to a universal possibility for human beings that defines us in our very nature as longing to be knowers. Most striking, perhaps, is the powerful claim that sight, most of all the senses, literally makes us know and brings to light many differences between things. Its language almost suggests a necessity that we come to know the things we see, or rather, that just by being sensual beings, with sight especially, we are situated in this world to come to know the things around us through our sight. However, if we were to read on and go beyond the excerpt that's normally included in the freshman lab manual, we would find Aristotle setting out a kind of hierarchy of human knowing in this chapter, a hierarchy in which sight and the senses seem to be relegated to the lower rungs, and in which the ever better faculties of memory and experience and the arts and sciences make way for and lead to wisdom in its truest sense. So sight seems to be demoted in this account. This suggests that for Aristotle, seeing and looking as such ultimately cannot by themselves teach us to investigate the natural world. Instead, it would appear that we have to seek a scientific understanding of natural things, and for Aristotle, that means we must investigate their causes, which aren't available to us through sight. And yet, before the ending of this chapter, Aristotle interrupts the flow of his remarks to observe that, although we don't regard any of the senses as wisdom, surely they give the most authoritative knowledge of particulars. They do not tell us the why of anything, the cause. For example, why fire is hot. They only say that it is hot. But this suggests, I think, that Aristotle includes this remark. I think it suggests that a respectful attention to seeing is indispensable to our study of nature. Thank you.
The laboratories always occupied a special place in the curriculum of St. John's College. Just look at the college seal. There are seven books standing for the seven liberal arts, and in the center is the balance representing the laboratory. The laboratory is not one of the traditional liberal arts, but it is central to what we do at the college. A little history helps explain how this came about. Stringfellow Barr and Scott Buchanan developed St. John's College curriculum as a response to what they saw as the pernicious effects of the elective system. Electives and the choice of majors and so forth are now taken completely for granted at most colleges and universities other than St. John's. It was not always so. The elective system began at a particular time, the late 19th century, and at a particular place, Harvard University. It was the handiwork of Harvard President Charles William Eliot, and importantly for this discussion, it was triggered by the introduction of scientific studies into the American university. The 19th century saw a radical change in American higher education. The mission of liberal arts colleges early in the century was principally to train young men, and they were almost always young men, for the learned professions, mostly the clergy. Those seeking other skills might attend vocational training schools or engage in apprenticeships. However, the technical demands of industry were fast becoming more than vocational schools could meet, and in the mid-century, scientific schools began to be appended to universities. The Lawrence Scientific School at Harvard opened in 1847, and similar schools soon opened at Yale, Dartmouth, and other places. Around the same time, the advent of the research university posed another challenge to liberal arts education. In 1873, Johns Hopkins University opened in Baltimore as an institution whose explicit purpose was not the education of undergraduates, but the advancement of knowledge by specialized faculty. Jealous of the academic reputation of the Hopkins faculty, Harvard President Eliot set out to improve his school's academic reputation by promoting specialization of the faculty. They too would become research professionals in their fields, like the teachers at the Lawrence Scientific School. As for undergraduates, their experience was transformed from a fixed curriculum of classical studies to a cafeteria of courses offered by departmental specialists. Harvard's elective plan was widely studied, admired, and imitated. By the early 20th century, almost all American colleges and universities had adopted some form of electives for undergraduate study. Thus, the introduction of scientific studies into universities was responsible, at least in part, for the educational situation that Barr and Buchanan sought to address with the St. John's College program. So in the official statement of the St. John's College program for 1938 to 39, one of the first years that the new program, call it the new program, existed, we read this, quote, "It should be recalled that it was for the purpose of introducing and assimilating the laboratory that Eliot of Harvard opened the liberal college to the elective system. The present disorganization of our colleges is evidence that the problem created by this change is not yet solved. It is of utmost importance that it be solved. St. John's College is making the attempt," close quote. Thus, from the beginning, one of the central purposes of the St. John's College program was to show that study of science can be integrated into a liberal arts curriculum. It is not an easy matter. Harvard University effectively threw up its hands and capitulated. The elective system effectively says to students, "We can't figure out what a proper education means, so you do it. Here are some choices, you're on your own." You're on your own. Unlike almost every other school in the country, St. John's College refuses to follow that path. Having said that, however, the task really isn't easy, technically, philosophically, pedagogically, or in any other way. It's remarkable that the 1938 statement of program just quoted says that St. John's College is making the attempt to place the laboratory among the liberal arts rather than claiming that we've found the magic answer to that problem. Later catalogs omit this confession. Nevertheless, I think it's fair to say that working out the role of the laboratory as it relates to the rest of the St. John's College curriculum is still, after 80 years, a work in progress. One thing that we do not want is to imitate the response of other institutions where science is the domain of specialized faculty whose principal teaching is directed at students who wish to enter the scientific professions. As a concession, science faculty occasionally offer watered-down versions of their courses for non-science majors who need to satisfy distribution requirements. Students in these classes are essentially tourists visiting the scientific realm that they're not expected fully to understand. Such a treatment would violate St. John's College's dedication to the unity of the educational project. It would be a surrender to the disorganization that the founders of the program wished to overcome. That said, the problem of the laboratory remains. How does one deal with the enormous importance of science in the modern world in a manner consistent with the rest of our program? a number of techniques have been tried. One can, for example, read science textbooks. Textbooks, of course, don't fit really well into the St. John's College approach to classes. They don't typically support good conversations. However, they do have certain advantages, the chief of which is they're written with the students in mind. If you're a beginner, a beginner's textbook should address you at the level of your level of knowledge and understanding. We don't read many textbooks now, but at various times in the past, our math and lab programs have used them. Then there's direct experience. That is, just placing students in front of an object of studying and seeing what happens. The first reading of the freshman laboratory, it's been alluded to, Samuel Scudder's essay on In the Laboratory with Agassiz, describes how the author was told to stare at a fish for hours, an exercise that he found surprisingly enlightening, even though he himself intended to study insects. We have a few such direct experience exercises. There's the initial meadow exercise in the freshman laboratory. At the beginning of the junior laboratory, there's often a session devoted more or less unguided experimentation with moving and falling objects. The advantage of this method is that it maximizes the unmediated confrontation with the natural world. The disadvantage is that students on their own can easily become lost and confused. Such direct experience exercises are useful, but are limited. Another approach would be to read books about science, either by historians or philosophers of science or others. Such books can provide panoramic views of scientific fields and develop intriguing historical theories. However, interesting as such books may be in themselves, they constitute another layer of mediation between the student and the subject matter. We do read some books about science. Francis Bacon's Novum Organum is one such work. So is Claude Bernard's Introduction to the Study of Experimental Medicine, that we read in freshman lab. Occasional essays read in lab classes also fall under this heading, but at present, this sort of work is a minor part of our laboratory. Finally, there's the attempt to treat the laboratory analogously to the seminar. That is, by identifying great books in science that stand alongside the books of the seminar list, works like Galileo's Two New Sciences or Charles Darwin's Origin of Species. There are evident advantages to this approach. It parallels the technique of the rest of the program. In studying the works of scientific masterpieces, we are exploring the thoughts of wonderfully imaginative and insightful authors. On the other hand, it has to be confessed that there are at least two major disadvantages to the great books of science approach. First, unlike textbooks, the masterworks of science are sometimes very difficult to read. That's not surprising, because the St. John's tutors and students were typically not their intended audience. This is especially true of the more recent works, but even older texts pose serious problems. The study of Euclid may prepare students to read and understand the Almagest, but the mathematics of Maxwell's treatise, to say nothing of Schrödinger and Dirac, require lots of supplemental notes to allow students even to glimpse what the authors are doing. Similar issues surround biology and chemistry as those fields develop in the 19th and 20th centuries. Scientific authors justifiably expect a certain level of expertise in their readers, and we don't necessarily have it. We have to hurry up to fill it in. The other disadvantage of the great books approach to science is something I call now-we-know-ism. When we read Priestley, for example, and discuss phlogiston theory, it is easy to think, oh, of course, now we know fire is oxidation, and we know that water is H2O. Then the class can seem like an exercise in willful ignorance and make-believe. It can seem as if we are conducting science in sort of a Ren Faire atmosphere, pretending that we don't know that atoms are real or that genetic information is propagated through DNA. One response to now we know-ism, facile but not untrue, is that we're not interested in whether our authors' theories are current or accepted by present-day scientific community. Instead, we want to investigate how the scientific mind operates. And we can do that as well or better in the past as we can in the present. So, for example, we read the Almagest, not to learn that the Earth is in the center of the world, but because Ptolemy gives us an ideal example of what it means to bend mathematics to save the phenomena. It's an approach to scientific theorizing that's still alive and well. References to Ptolemy are common in senior labs studying quantum mechanics. At its worst, now-we-know-ism can degenerate into ill-informed gossip sessions about what students remember from high school science classes or from YouTube videos. I firmly believe that we learn much more about how to encounter the natural world by looking at the arguments of William Harvey and De Motu Cordis or Charles Darwin's Origin of the Species than by obtaining second and third-hand accounts of what goes on at CERN or over at Los Alamos. That having been said, however, some doubts linger. Modern science poses challenges that we in the college don't really address. We can tell ourselves that we need not chase after the most modern theories because, after all, they're likely to change in coming years, as all prior theories have changed. And that may be true, or it may be a case of sour grapes. We don't have the time, energy, or dedication to understand the most recent developments, so we tell ourselves that it's not important to do so. In any event, the problem is much bigger than our pedagogic successes or failures. The scientific world today works at a scale that no single person is capable of understanding fully. It takes a lifetime to become an expert in some small facet of this or that discipline. Scientific papers are authored by dozens of individuals and rely on the work of hundreds more. That may be an innocuous fact, or it may become a socially and politically important issue if, as we've seen recently, scientific experts tell us that we need to change our behavior in important ways on the basis of research that neither we nor our elected representatives can hope to understand. That's a problem that we don't really address at St. John's, and that I can't address responsibly in the time that I have left, so I won't.
Good evening. I just want to say quickly at the beginning that the freshmen in freshman lab are living a kind of charmed life right now. They just wander in the woods in the ski basin and read Aristotle. I mean, if that's not heaven, I don't know what is. So I feel like I may try to, my contribution tonight was to be trying to make the Aristotle part of that maybe a little more interesting for them or a little more accessible. I'm restricting myself to just talking about a small piece of the early readings of freshman lab, just Aristotle's Parts of Animals, and really just the first chapter of that, and then just one thread of that in particular. So in the first chapter of Parts of Animals, Aristotle begins by saying that there are certain questions that must be answered before we can inquire into nature and into the nature of animals. And I just want to discuss what he has in mind there. I think the most crucial question turns out being whether the, quote, for the sake of which, end quote, or the, quote, material cause, end quote, or the closely allied term necessity, are the fundamental causes in natural beings and animals in particular. And I'm going to use those phrases, material cause or for the sake of which, and necessity a lot. I'm not going to, every time I'm doing it, I'm not going to say it's a quote from Aristotle. I think Aristotle's argument about which is more primary, the for the sake of which, or necessity, or material, that argument will hinge on the reality of the living animal and its needs as the primary thing, and all the other causes are to be understood in reference to the actual living animal. So Aristotle begins by telling us that the person who is educated, that's his term, educated, should be able to judge whether someone has spoken nobly or not about a matter. And in fact, he suggests there might be a wholly educated person, a completely educated person who can do this about everything, about any one of the disciplines. And immediately it makes me wonder whether such a comprehensive ability could exist or what would have to be true for that kind of power to exist. But that, so Aristotle says, and I think more reasonably at first, that someone might be educated in that way, but with respect only to a certain nature, not comprehensively. But I do wonder if the comprehensive education does exist, if there really is a whole of understanding and not merely an aggregate of the different of knowledge about the different natures, then what really would be questionable is whether the partially educated person is actually educated at all, because it would seem like that person would need to, the part that they know would imply other parts that they don't know. So I do wonder whether the comprehensively educated person really is the more truly educated person, even if we wonder if this is possible. And if it's not possible, I don't think the partially educated person is really possible either. So with that problem kind of up front, I want to move on to what he says the educated person knows. He says what they know is how a demonstration should proceed. Of course, a familiar term from math tutorial. And he seems to say that this kind of understanding of what a demonstration is not limited to a particular discipline, but there's a sort of absolute knowledge of what demonstrations are. And he says, and this is an interesting quote, outside of the truth, or apart from the truth, end quote, it could be known what a demonstration is in a particular science. So even if you have not yet studied living things or do not yet have the science of living things, if you know what demonstrations are, you should be able to say in advance what kind of questions there are about these living things and how they should be answered before you even start. So to give an example of what this is, I think this is a kind of simple example. It's very interesting. He says, so in the world of living things, there are certain universal activities that they have. And he lists sleep, breathing, growth, decay, death. And he says there's sort of a problem, which is those things cut across all the kinds of animals. So it may seem redundant to talk about what sleep is in a dog, and what sleep is in a cat, and what sleep is in a zebra, et cetera. On the other hand, he says, if you apply this thinking to locomotion, to local motion, a motion from place to place, then you may be doing something too abstract. And I think a good example is, you know, walking is motion, or even better, a caterpillar creeping is in motion, and a bird flying is in motion. And if you say they're both in motion, you might be missing something. Whereas I think you might not be missing something if you say that, you know, caterpillars and birds like both sleep. I don't know if caterpillars sleep, but if they do both sleep, that might not be a problem. But it does seem that, you know, flying and creeping are different enough. There may be a problem there, and I think that could be a paradigm. So that, I think Aristotle says the educated person is able to judge which of those approaches is the correct one ahead of time. But I want to get to the more to what I think is the more crucial issue here, which is whether the natural beings, including animals, are governed by what I've been calling the for the sake of which, or the final cause. I know final cause is what other panelists are talking about, so I won't spend too much time on it. Or whether the material cause, or what's a very similar necessity, is the fundamental cause in studying animals. And so first, just to explain the for the sake of which, Aristotle gives two examples. You have a doctor, you know, a physician, and the goal of the physician is health. That's the for the sake of which, what the physician does. And with a builder, the for the sake of which they do what they do is the house they want to build. And so this, if we look at the house builder, we see though that material and necessity have to enter into how we understand what they do. And consider, for example, the cutting wood. So that requires a hatchet or a saw, which has to be hard, so it has to be made of metal, so it has to be made of iron and bronze. And so you can see that there's a kind of what Aristotle calls conditional necessity that has a sort of hypothetical character. So you can't just say, the builder's goal is to build a house. If you really want to understand house building, you have to understand the tools of the trade, and that requires understanding something about what houses can be made of. And you can see something similar applying to animals. The carnivore must eat, so it needs teeth, so those have to be hard, and those have to be made of bone. But there is a difference, which is that in the case of animals, it's not hypothetical, is it? The animal actually exists. So in a sense, it's sort of retrospective. And here's some of the ways Aristotle phrases this. So he says, in the best case, one should say that since this is what it is to be a human, therefore he has these things, for he cannot be without these things. Failing that, one should speak as closely as possible to this manner, and either say that it is impossible otherwise, or else that it is beautiful at any rate in this way. I find that kind of an interesting addition there, that we're maybe not only considering how things have to be, but also we can also answer this question by saying how things could come to be beautifully. And here's another rephrasing of it I think is also very helpful. So because he is such, meaning the human being, his coming to be necessarily happens in this way and is such. Hence, this part comes to be first, and then this one, and one should speak in this manner likewise about all the things that are constituted by nature. So in this case, we're looking at the genesis of the human being and how, you know, the embryo develops, which will be a topic later in lab. And it seems like that process also has to kind of be understood on the basis of the complete organism. And then at the end, he says, we should speak in this manner likewise about all the things constituted by nature. And I think that's interesting because it sort of implies that animals are a paradigmatic case of natural beings that shed light on all the other ones. So if the freshman lab were interested in nature as a whole, then it becomes very sensible and reasonable that we should begin with animals. And I'm kind of running to the end here, so I just want to note two more features of this account. And one is that Aristotle is giving this account so in opposition to the kind of account that his predecessors give, previous philosophers. And he tells us the previous philosophers sought to explain the whole cosmos, animals and plants, simply by material bodies and whatever sets them in motion. So those accounts privilege the process by which something comes to be and the material conditions of that being over the character of the nature of the being itself. So it's almost as if we took that hypothetical necessity or conditional necessity where we said that hammer needs to hammer a nail, so it has to be hard, so it has to be made of iron, and started instead in the other direction from the iron somehow and tried to understand the hammer as somehow a product of iron rather than the iron and the hammer as a product of the function of the hammer. And Aristotle says that was pretty much how everybody before him, with some more sophisticated or more subtle versions, thought about these things. But Aristotle thinks, I think, that this kind of reasoning is part of the study of animals. He says one must say that the animal is of such a sort. I think that's the final cause, for the sake of which, you know, that comes from the character of the animal. But he also says one must speak about that, both what it is and what sort it is, and about each of its parts. And he says those who don't explain these two things, or at least try to, say nothing. And Aristotle gives us an example of how we could go about doing this. Breathing is for the sake of this, but it comes to be of necessity on account of these things. And by these things he means the way air behaves when it's heated versus how it's cooled and how that affects the motion of the air. And necessity signifies something that, if that, the for the sake of which will be, it's necessary to have these things. But sometimes it signifies that such is their state and nature. So if we want to understand breathing, we have to understand why animals breathe. What do they need that breathing gets them? On the other hand, I don't think we can understand the functioning of the lungs without knowing something about air and how air behaves. And why does air behave the way it do? It does. We can't get behind that, I don't think, for Aristotle. And he does say that when we're inquiring about nature, there's a limit that we can't get behind. And then one last note here is that within this thinking, where it seems to be Aristotle says, okay, you can think about the character of a being, which leads to the thought about final cause, or you can think about the material conditions of that natural being, but you have to think about both of those. The question is, which is in the driver's seat? He gives a very qualified statement about what actually the final cause, what the final cause or the character of the being is. And he suggests it might be soul, but he says this in such a qualified way, I just have to quote it. So he says, one must speak about what sort it is and each its parts, just as one would speak about the form of the bed. Now, if this is soul, or a part of the soul, or not without soul, when soul is departed at any rate, there's no longer an animal. Now, if this is so, it would be for the student of nature to speak and to know about soul. And if not all soul, then about that part in virtue of which the animal is of such a sort. So I just wanted to make a gesture to that possibility that the studying of living things might lead to the study of soul. But that Aristotle makes that suggestion in a very qualified way with a lot of ifs. So enjoy reading Aristotle.
George Box was an English statistician. He's credited with being the person who coined the phrase, all models are wrong, but some models are useful. I want to talk about classification as an example of models, classification, which we do a lot of in the freshman laboratory and also in the senior laboratory, and speak about the ways in which, actually I'd like to start with the ways in which models, some models are useful, and then go to the problem that all models are wrong. I think some models are essential. We don't go through the day without a huge framework of classification. Everyone, whether or not they had seen these particular doors to this room, managed to navigate through the doors by recognizing doors, not, it's that door, I know that door. The same with this chair, even if you haven't sat in that chair before. There's a way in which our categorization of the world allows us to encounter individual objects for the first time and know how to begin our interaction with them. Sometimes it's sufficient to carry us through an entire interaction with them. Sometimes we'll get to where models break down. But I want to begin just by observing that classification isn't a strange thing that we do in the laboratory, that we impose on the world in a way that is unjustified. It's essential to our daily activity. It's essential for me being able to speak to you without turning to each of you and getting to know you in some way before I can talk. But it's a starting point. We classify for purpose, and just as for every purpose we might have in a given encounter, a given day, a given circumstance, a given role we're playing, we might have different models of classification. That's why some people will ask you, tomato or cucumber, are these fruits or are they vegetables? Well, we have two different schema. If you ask the botanist who's interested in where the seeds are, they might say they're fruit. If you ask the person who's cooking, they're gonna say, when I serve these, I call them vegetables. There's not a problem with that. There are other examples. But we classify for all sorts of reasons. We classify to understand what we are allowed to eat, what is safe to eat. We classify according to cultural norms and recognize things collectively, sometimes even unconsciously. We have our own particular forms of classification. And then within disciplines, academic disciplines, within occupations, we classify according to the needs or the rules or the training we've had in those occupations. There are countless ways of classifying. When we get to the laboratory, I think there's a presumption that what we're supposed to be doing is classifying things in a scientific way. At least that's sometimes what I see in the back of students' minds. I'm supposed to be doing a particular kind of activity here when I classify conifers, when I classify organs, when I classify parts of flowers. What is it I'm supposed to be doing? Well, there's that lurking word, scientific, which I'm going to steer away from. I think scientific is a term that can be understood in a lot of different ways, and I'll let Mr. Frank's introduction to the history of the elective program pointed to one of them. That is, science is often understood to be in service of industry or in service of the ability to manipulate. There are other ways of understanding science, and I didn't come to understand those ways really fully until recently. I grew up in a family of scientists, and I thought of science as something else. I'll get to that later. So I'm going to go back to the term I prefer for what we do at St. John's and call our activity natural philosophy. It's got a long history. It doesn't have a clear disjoint, except perhaps with respect to the cordoning off of those things that are done to be useful in a material sense. And so I want to, when I speak about purpose and classification, I guess I'm going to speak as a philosopher. I'm not a philosopher. I'm going to speak as I wish I could, were I a philosopher. And that's where part two comes in. So part one is some models are useful. All models have their uses. They came about for a purpose. All models are wrong. One can be merely a technician and classify according to a system, and that's oftentimes what we learn, or sometimes when someone asks us to classify scientifically, that's where our mind goes. Oh, I know these belong to something. I can look up, I can find the genus, I can find the species, or I can recognize what the distinguishing characteristics are. And the work of a technician then is to take objects and put them into boxes. The work of a philosopher is to make boxes or rearrange boxes or question the boxes or find that things don't quite fit. That's what I think we do in the laboratory here, is we ask where the models are wrong for the sake of creating better models. That is to say, for the sake of achieving our purposes more fully. I should speak about, I should just digress on purpose. Let me just offer a placeholder first. I think the purpose of a natural philosopher is to examine the world of which we are a part in order to better understand ourselves. There are a lot of different ways one could go with that, but I realize it might be helpful to give an example of what I mean by purpose as a philosopher in constructing models. It has the world, it has its part, it has us in it. Those can have many different arrangements. All models are wrong. Some models are wrong. Oh, all models are wrong, first of all, because they're all a subset. They're a reduction of what is into more limited dimensions of being. They're simply not. I mean, the only model that serves as a model for the world is the world. Anything less than that is a reduction of some aspect of its being or of its activity. All models are wrong because also in that activity, they are distortions. They end up pointing to some characteristics and ignoring others. We have to make decisions when we make models about what are germane to our purpose and ask if that seemed to be appropriate. In those ways, all models are wrong. But I'd like to explore the ways in which some models have better uses. That is, we can identify the ways in which some models are more wrong than others. And that would be for this particular purpose. The most general one is when a model is used for some other purpose. A model is developed for one reason, and it gets imposed in another realm. There's sort of a mission creep. You know, this model turned out to be really nice, and it got popular, and then it begins to be the model, the template on which we put other things. There was an interesting article that I read, only because my brother gave it to me. I don't have time to read journal articles, but it was on the IAU's International Astronomical Union's redefinition of planet in, I think, 2006, that took Pluto out of planet status. And their argument was Galileo's model was a useful model, served a purpose. Galileo called the moon a planet, and he called the Earth a planet. And all of the objects that weren't fixed stars were planets. Over time, and for some very complex and curious reasons, including a public fascination with astrology, which happened after monarchs began not appointing court astrologers, and astrologers had to write books and sell them, but also with a moral purpose that moral arguments in the 19th century involved the regularity of the planet's orbits to think of as models for our own behavior. Somehow, the original definition of planet had gotten lost, and in the 20th century, after a lull of discussing what a planet was, astronomers began to rewrite their own history as though regularity was an important part and a direct orbit of the sun, not a secondary orbit. Regularity was an important part of the definition of a planet. And so, regularity, of course, required not to have interfering objects, so planets had to have clear orbits. They had their own places to move. And that led to this vote. And you'll see a vote, for those who've read the Freshman Lab, the Congress at Karlsruhe will vote on what a molecule is. We can think about whether or not voting is the right way to determine appropriate models. But the argument of this paper was the purpose for defining a planet as those things which aren't stars, and their point now is, and aren't interstellar dust, is that everything on our scale, everything that could be of interest to us in the cosmos, where we came from, occurs in this middle level. And to arbitrarily rule out things from being in this middle level doesn't serve the purpose anymore of identifying a realm. So that was a model that got written for reasons that were unclear to its writers. Because of cultural movement. That maybe is more a category, I'd say, of an insidious creep instead of an intentional one. We borrow from other realms inappropriately. That is to say, a moral purpose got turned into a scientific purpose without even thinking about it. Maybe a more straightforward example of mission creep would be the use of phylogenetic relations among animals to speak of relatedness of animals. That is to say, the evolutionary relatedness of animals defines their place. There are a lot of ways of speaking about an animal's place, and evolutionary relatedness would be one. It serves a lot of purposes. But if it gets used to speak about relatedness more generally, then it's working outside of its intended purpose. The philosopher's question has to be, is this schema appropriate for this purpose? Which asks us first to wrestle with the question of purpose. I think one doesn't have to decide that one is going to come to one with the cosmos in understanding in order to look at the parts of a flower. We can presume that we're curious, as Aristotle says in the Metaphysics, by nature, and the exploration is itself sometimes a satisfactory first ground for exploring. It's what we do here a lot at the college, which is to confront something novel and ask, what does this seem to be saying on its own? And recognize then that we're bringing to it our own interpretations and wrestling with it for what it might be more on its own than from our perspective. An example, so going back to the phylogenetic relatedness of animals, we might say the shape of an organism tells us something about it. The shape of its molecules tell us something about it. That's one kind of classification. But we might also be interested in, and those can be done with dead or living animals. In fact, it's more convenient to do them when they're dead and look at their parts. But if we're asking about the relatedness of animals that are living, we might ask what their activity is when they're living, or with whom they interact, and what the form of those interactions are. None of those are contained in its phylogenetic history. So we might think that our questions have more to do with what is it doing than what is its shape. But we have to be clear about the purpose of our activity, and then be clear, or try to unravel the assumptions we've come into with bringing purpose into the question. I think Aristotle, to go back to the recurring topic here, wrestled very well with the questions of division and classification, and the relation of the genera to the species, the generic to the specific, and what that process is. Not just in parts of animals which we read, I discovered huge tracts of text which I did not read in on topics. Charles Darwin, who was far better read than I was, when he reflected on Linnaeus's contribution to classification, Linnaeus's system of morphological classification is really unchanged for the most part with our molecular tools for phylogenetic relations. So Linnaeus is really the founder of a kind of study of evolutionary history of animals by their relatedness. Charles Darwin is standing on Linnaeus's shoulders looking at the natural world, and he said, compared to Aristotle, Linnaeus was merely a schoolboy. And I think that's not to diminish the accomplishments of Linnaeus, but I think it's to remind us of the significance of the wrestling with the questions of what it means to put things in categories, or what it means to divide two things or bring two things together, that Aristotle outlined so clearly, not just giving us the fruits of a particular form of division. Thank you.
So when I wrote this several weeks ago at this point, I had COVID, so let's see if it still makes sense. Right? I'm gonna be speaking about an aspect of freshman lab, but it's also an important topic for any student at St. John's to think about throughout their time here, and I think even beyond. And the topic that I've chosen is teleology, which is an explanation of something in terms of that thing's end or purpose. So more succinctly, a logos in terms of telos. And I want to start with just a bit of a justification. Teleology is a rather specific topic in the broad scope of freshman lab, so why single it out? I think that this issue is illustrative of both the intellectual opportunities and dangers facing students at St. John's, not just in the lab, but across much of the curriculum, and in fact, not just in freshman year, but during the entirety of a student's time here. So let me step back and build my way up to that larger claim by starting with the basics. Specifically, I want to consider Aristotle's treatment of teleology in his work, The Physics. Now, since we are separated from Aristotle by over two millennia, we have to take extra care not to commit some very common errors that stand in the way of us understanding him. When modern readers read Aristotle, and this applies just as much to his political and ethical works as it does to his scientific works, we are prone to committing a double error. First, I think we tend to believe prematurely that we understand what Aristotle is saying. And second, I think we tend to accept uncritically the premises of modernity, even when those premises have not been demonstrated to be true. Of course, I'm not talking about people at St. John's. I just mean modern people in general, right? In the case of science, we almost always assume that modern science rests on solid foundations buttressed by mountains of evidence. And so anything that goes against the current of modern science, like much of Aristotle's physics, appears quaint, perhaps charming and fun to read, but certainly mistaken. So how do these errors manifest themselves with respect to teleology specifically? Well, first, Aristotle is often thought to be rather dogmatic in his belief that every being acts for the sake of a purpose and that the cosmos as an ordered whole itself displays characteristics of purpose-driven activity. And it's important that we read him carefully so that we can see for ourselves whether he really believed that, and if he did believe that, whether that belief was in fact dogmatic or perhaps reasonable. Second, in a world in which the triumph of modern science is a foregone conclusion, it's often taken for granted that teleology is an inherently misguided framework for understanding nature. Instead, it is often believed that material and efficient causes are sufficient for understanding any natural being, even living beings. Now, just to be clear, that might all be true. Aristotle might believe, perhaps even naively, that the cosmos is a neatly ordered whole in which everything has its proper place. And material and efficient causes might offer a comprehensive explanation of natural beings. So I'm not suggesting that making those claims is itself necessarily an error. The error is believing either of those claims on insufficient grounds as a result of our particular prejudices as inhabitants of the modern world. So I am not in my remarks going to be suggesting any conclusions one way or the other. What I will be doing is bringing to light a set of interrelated questions that I think for many of us are typically left in the dark. And that is the intellectual danger that I referred to just a moment ago. But of course, in facing this danger, we have the opportunity to free ourselves of prejudice and pursue the truth. So with that in mind, let's think about what Aristotle says in the Physics about final causes. Because when we talk about teleology, that's what we mean. And what Aristotle says in Book 2, Chapter 3 is this. I'm leaving out a few words here and there without altering the meaning, and this is from Joe Sachs' translation of the text. One way cause is meant is that out of which something comes into being. In another way, it is the form or pattern. In yet another, it is that from which the first beginning of change or rest is. And in still another way, it is meant as an end. So there you have the four causes, and Aristotle goes on to elaborate on the final cause. This is that for the sake of which, he says, as health is of walking around. Why is he walking around? We say in order to be healthy, and in so saying, we think we have completely given the cause. So final cause is one of these four different types of cause, and what do these four things have in common? What does it mean that they are causes? As Aristotle says at the beginning of the same chapter, we think we do not yet know each thing until we have taken hold of the why of it. And then he goes on to discuss the four causes. So final cause is one way for us to answer the question why. Why does this thing exhibit this characteristic? For the sake of something. That's one way we can answer that question. And Aristotle's first example of a why question is why does a human being walk around? And his first example of a final cause is, which is a partial answer to the why question, is so that he can be healthy. So when it comes to human volition, final cause is, I think, straightforward and rather uncontroversial. If someone asks you why you drove to the airport yesterday and you say, well, my brain sent electrical signals to my legs, which then pressed down the pedal of the car, you have not properly answered the question. The person wants to know, for what purpose did you go to the airport? And if you leave purpose out of your answer, you have not given a complete explanation or much of an explanation at all. Final cause, I think, also straightforwardly applies to artifacts or products of human art. The final cause of a knife, the end for which it exists, is to cut. And this reasoning applies to less tangible artifacts as well. The final cause of a law is presumably the good of the political community, or at least the good of some portion of the political community. So when we consider the final cause of artifacts, we're really not doing anything different than considering the final cause of voluntary action broadly. Just as someone might walk around for the sake of their health, a legislator might create a law for the sake of some political objective. So it seems, again, that when it comes to human action, final cause is an indispensable element of explanation. But now let's get to the harder and more interesting case, because Aristotle does not just apply final cause to voluntary action. He applies it to natural, non-volitional beings. For convenience, we will call these plants. Aristotle says in Book 2, Chapter 8, it becomes apparent that even in plants, what is brought together comes about in relation to the end, as the leaves for the sake of protection for the fruit. And since Aristotle is willing to say this about plants, he obviously has no problem describing the actions of non-rational animals in terms of final cause as well. He gives the examples of the work of spiders and ants. But to focus on plants, because that's, I think, where the difficulty becomes clear, in what sense can we describe the development of leaves in terms of final cause? When we say that a human being walks around for the sake of health, it sounds like we are describing a choice that is made with an end in mind. So if I accidentally find $5 when I'm walking, but I had absolutely no intention of finding money when I set out to walk, I wouldn't call finding the money the final cause of my walking. Nor would Aristotle. He would call that luck or fortune. So final cause, when it describes human action, seems to involve deliberation, intelligence, choice. So what does it mean to say that the leaves of a plant exist for the sake of protecting the fruit? Now, if the plants were little Adams and Eves and they thought to themselves, my fruit is exposed and I need to cover it with leaves, then there would be no conceptual difficulty whatsoever. But that's not, as far as we can tell, how it works. The plant, without deliberating, develops leaves as if it were deliberating. But then again, why should we describe the formation of protective leaves in terms of final cause? Why not simply say, this is the matter of the plant, which grows into leaves, and this is the process of growth through which the leaves come into existence, material and efficient causes? What do we achieve by talking about purpose other than anthropomorphizing the plant? It seems to me that there are two possibilities, and I want to start with the grander of the two. Maybe there is an intelligence governing the development of plant leaves, and maybe that intelligence is not in the plant itself. So just as human beings can create a world of artifacts with intelligent design, even though the intelligence is in us and not in the artifacts themselves, why can't divine beings similarly create a world of natural things with intelligent design? So the blade of a knife is crafted by man for the sake of cutting. Similarly, the leaves of a plant are crafted by God for the sake of protecting the fruit. And just as a brief aside, perhaps obvious, but I think very important, modern science has not ruled out, and in fact can never rule out, that the world we inhabit is the product of either a single divine intelligence or a plurality of divine intelligences. It's not within the capability of science to prove a negative. And what I'm about to say in the quote I'm about to read, I got from a book by Tutor Emeritus David Bolitin, so I just want to mention that. There's a French biochemist named Jacques Monod who wrote a book, Chance and Necessity, and he was hardly a theist or even a deist, but he says that modern science rests on, quote, the postulate of objectivity. Now, you all know the epistemological status of a postulate from doing Euclid, and Monod concedes that this postulate of objectivity is, quote, forever undemonstrable. For, he continues, it is obviously impossible to imagine an experiment which could prove the non-existence anywhere in nature of a purpose, of a pursued end. So the possibility of teleology in that grand sense remains unrefuted. But what does Aristotle think? Does he believe in what I'm calling this grander possibility, in divine intelligence that guides the development of individual beings? I think that's a question that has to be kept in mind when you read Aristotle. But I also want to explore the other possibility. If we put aside the possibility of divine intelligence, with the understanding that we have done nothing to refute that possibility, if we nevertheless put it aside, how else might his description of leaves in terms of final cause make sense? Well, perhaps even in the absence of intelligent design, material and efficient causes are insufficient as descriptions of living beings. In fact, maybe we can only understand the material conditions of a plant in terms of the plant's end or purpose. A given plant might have leaves, roots, a stem, and a flower, but do you have any idea what a root is if you can't describe how it contributes to the sustained existence of the plant? In fact, a little bit of reflection will reveal that teleology is embedded in our everyday, ordinary language. We call a plant healthy or sick, depending on a number of factors, but those words, healthy and sick, are teleological. you're speaking as if the plant is trying to do something, as if it's aiming at some particular goal. And sometimes it succeeds, and we say it's healthy, and sometimes it fails, and therefore it's sick. We do not simply say, these are two different conditions about which I can say no more. Now, someone might deny the importance of this observation by saying that it only has to do with our habits of speech and not with the world as it exists in itself. But I suspect that Aristotle would reject or at least heavily scrutinize that distinction. Yes, we have to clarify our speech, but by natural world, I think Aristotle means precisely the world as it is experienced, understood, and expressed in speech by rational beings. And as soon as you try to describe the world that you inhabit and perceive, you imply the existence of final cause as if final cause is an inherent part of the world, by saying things like, this tree is flourishing or this cactus is sick. Now, somebody might also say this sounds like a modern imposition onto Aristotle. They might say that I'm making Aristotle sound like a skeptical modern phenomenologist. So I want to justify this reading slightly by returning to the text of the Physics. As it turns out, the ancients, even well before Aristotle, were perfectly aware of the argument that the world came into existence purely by chance. And Aristotle gives a completely coherent account of this argument in Book 2, Chapter 4. He says, there are some who make chance responsible for this cosmos and all worlds, for they say that by chance there came about a vortex and a motion of separating out and settling into this arrangement of the whole. Now, if we just replace the word vortex with bang, these ancients seem rather prescient. In the same chapter, Aristotle says that this argument is strange and mightily worth wondering at. A few pages later in Book 2, Chapter 8, Aristotle summarizes a different but related argument. Not that the cosmos as a whole came into being by chance, but that the particular features of living beings came into being by chance. This is one of the most remarkable passages, I think, from the Physics, so I just want to read it in its entirety. He says, what prevents nature from doing things, not for the sake of anything, nor because they are best, but out of necessity? What prevents the parts in something that is by nature, say the teeth growing with the front one sharp, suitable for tearing, but the molars flat and useful for grinding the food, although not happening for the sake of this, but just falling together? Likewise with the other parts, to however many being for the sake of something seems to belong. Wherever something happened to come together, just as if it had been put together for the sake of something, these were preserved, having been put together advantageously by chance. Anything that is not like that has perished and still perishes. So what is this argument that Aristotle summarizes for us saying more simply? There are all kinds of plants, for example, that come into being by chance. And some of them happen to have leaves that protect the fruit. And of course, that's the fruit that survives while the rest perish. So obviously, it will seem as if the plants that survive were designed for the sake of survival, but that's just because those are the ones that survived. Now, this argument, it must be noted, is rejected by Aristotle. But as is always the case, it does almost nothing for us to note simply that he rejects it. The important question to ask is why? On what grounds does he reject a way of looking at the world that insists on the primacy of chance? Is it because it is clear to him that the world and all the natural beings in it are the product of divine intelligence rather than chance? Or is it because whether there are gods or not, we can only begin to understand our world and the beings in it if we are willing to admit how they appear to us, that is, as beings organized towards ends, in light of which we must try to understand the beings as wholes? And whether you've studied the Physics before or whether you will do it in detail for the first time this year, I would urge everyone to keep that question in mind. And since I am the last one to speak, I will tell everybody that we will take 5 minutes off and then we'll be back here for questions. Thank you.